Danilana Kitchen talks about food. Danilana Kitchen talks recipes. Danilana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on
Community Radio.
Welcome to the Danilana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintos.
We gather here once a week around our kitchen table to talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. And we are here at the studios of KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames, Iowa, the center of everything. Yes, it is the center of Iowa. The center.
I like to call it the middle of the middle of the middle.
It is. What could you be just kind of more cozy right here on a day like this of all things?
Yeah.
Well, lots goes on here at KHOI Community Radio. We're not just talking to you over the ether. There are events here, and I would like to mention a fine one coming up this Thursday. KHOI is sponsoring a fall author spotlight series, and this Thursday, Joe Gia will be talking about his book.
That's December 8th.
December 8th.
Yeah.
Thursday, yes. And it just so happens.
Friday.
8th? Are we going to argue about Thursday or Friday?
It's Friday.
It's Friday. It's Friday. Oh, my. Okay.
Eh.
Okay. Anyway, it's December 8th. Look on your calendars if there's any confusion.
Thank you. Very good. Anyway, KHOI sponsors a lot of good stuff in its large Studio C, which holds people and performers and people talking, and it's a good thing to come to. So, today on the Danilana Kitchen, we have in our kitchen Joe Gia. He's the author of the book, Kitchen Arabic.
Subtitled, How My Family Came to America and the Recipes We Brought With Us.
Oh, very good. Joe Gia is Professor Emeritus at Iowa State University, and he has also authored the book Through and Through, Toledo Stories, and Lebanese Blonde, and some other good stuff. Welcome, Joe.
Thank you.
Good. And joining him is Fern Kupfer, and they have a project they will be speaking about later. Fern Kupfer is an American author and retired professor also.
And Mrs. Joe Gia. And we got to say that.
Yeah.
Writing at the University
of Wisconsin. Names, yeah, right.
There we go.
I'm the backup singer for this talk,
yeah.
Right?
Okay.
So we are thrilled to have both of you in the kitchen with us today. There are so many good stories start in the kitchen. Yes, they do. And Kitchen Arabic is a wonderful collection of stories and the food that goes with it. So Joe moved here with his family quite a while ago from Lebanon, which actually at the time was maybe Syria, maybe Lebanon. That's a story in itself. But this book starts out with a phrase that translates to, it happened, it didn't happen. And then it goes into coming into America. Tell us about the book, Joe.
Well, it's a collection of stories that make up a memoir with recipes, which is what the book essentially is. The memoir comes from Khan Makan. Is the introduction to family stories. In Arabic, Khan Makan means it happened, or maybe it didn't happen. So it is a kind of once upon a time. And when storytellers in the Arabic tradition begin a story, that's how they start, with Khan Makan. Believe it or don't believe it. Maybe it happened, maybe it didn't. Here's the story. You know, enjoy it or don't. Yeah. And essentially that's how I started my book, too. The family stories are the stories that I grew up with. My coming to America, I was 2 years old. I remember nothing. All I know of it are the stories I was told growing up. And those are the stories that I have incorporated into Kitchen Arabic, along with the recipes, because food was a very important part of our growing up. My dad ran a grocery store, and my mother, who did not know how to cook when she married him, learned from him. And then she, I think, far surpassed his cooking because she was a natural. And she was a very good cook. And I've incorporated her recipes, hopefully, as accurately as I could into the book. I wanted things to taste like she made them.
And I want to just say something about the genre of Kitchen Arabic, because is it a memoir? Is it a cookbook? Well, it's both, because I think, you know, when you have traditional cookbooks now, you can look up any recipe on Google, but these are wonderful stories, too. So I think librarians don't know where to put it. You know, it's like, is it a memoir? That's what they ask at the bookstore downtown. Is it a memoir? Is it a cookbook? Well, it's both. Is it actually in the memoir section at Dog-Eared Books?
It should be. Well, two sections. You can think about two copies.
I say put it in both.
Put it in both. It is. It is. Wonderful stories. And we forget how the topic of immigrants comes up. Oh, my. But realize all of us came. My folks came probably before the turn of the last century, but pretty close right up there. And when so much stuff to learn. I mean, you have stories, Joe, about your father. He was quite a character, but really, yeah. Truly, having to learn the language and make do with pretty much nothing when you arrive on these shores. They ended up in Toledo, of all places.
Yeah. We ended up in Toledo because my father had first ended up in Toledo when he came here. His first trip to America was as a 12-year-old stowaway. And I tell his story in the book. He was, I guess, your illegal alien, you would call him. And his story involves child trafficking and how he came to America via that really unfortunate experience, which he never saw as unfortunate. He saw the best side of it. He thought he lucked out, where in today's, looking through the modern lens, we see that he was really a used and abused person. So he was a difficult person, a very complicated person. He had some beautiful sides to him and some awful, frightening ones as well. And I think it had a lot to do with his growing up and his having to grow up by himself in America. He came to, he ended up in Toledo as a young boy. And
was that because there was already a Lebanese community?
Yes. Toledo, Detroit, Cleveland, it's kind of like a modern Fertile Crescent. It was an area that, for instance, Dearborn, Michigan, which is just outside Detroit, for a while had the largest Arabic-speaking population outside the Middle East. And so people were attracted to the Ford plants, to the auto industry. And the idea was, come to America. Let me turn this off a second here. The idea was to come to America and to become your own boss, run your own business. But you had to work for somebody else first. And the Lebanese immigrants who came around the turn of the century came and became what my father called hucksters. They were door-to-door salespeople, and they would go and sell what we called white goods, which is linens, tablecloths, scissors, thread, yarn. And they'd go door-to-door, Mrs. Scissors today, Mrs., you know. And that was how they learned English. It's how they learned the money and how they saved up their money to open their own business, which was the whole point of coming here. The idea was to come to America and shovel gold from the streets.
Good job. Good job. The idea of having to make your money on needles and thread. And
that's
it
right.
Worked. He
yeah.
ended up with a grocery store in Toledo. Did you live above the grocery store?
Yes, we did. This was on Monroe Street in Toledo, which was in the, excuse me, the near downtown area. And we lived in an apartment above it. In fact, I've done a painting of it. If I could just show you.
It's hard to show on radio.
Yeah, but it was, yeah, my deepest dreams go back to that place. I'm there again as a child when I see that place. And it was very important to me, although we only spent about 4 years there. But it was an important 4 years, I guess, for me.
So how did he get from the white goods business into the grocery business?
Well, for a while he was a bootlegger. He came. He was 56 years old when I was born. So he'd
had a major life before children then.
Exactly.
He had another wife while he was still.
That's part of the story. Yes.
Yeah, sure. He was a bigamist.
It's fascinating.
Yeah, he went from white goods to prohibition, and he was a bootlegger. He was a barber. He was a restaurant, I guess maybe a short order cook, maybe. He ran his own restaurant, a little place. It was a diner, really. He went through a lot of different types. He was a barber for a while, and I still remember. He had something about red-headed women because he said he had a red-headed woman barber, the first woman barber in Chicago working for him. This was the way he told stories. I don't know if it was true or if he made it up. But, yeah, that was... And the Lebanese, like a lot of the Koreans as of maybe 20 years ago, were also involved in the grocery business, Korean immigrants. So too the Lebanese during their period of coming over in the 30s and 40s.
Good, good. So you spend, your book says you spent a lot of time in your mama's kitchen because food is so good. But what was your father's grocery store like? Big, little?
Well, no, it was a butcher shop, and with groceries in the front. He had a butcher shop in the back, sawdust on the floor in the back, where he cut meat. He didn't butcher the animals, but he was a meat cutter. And, what would happen is because it was a small store, and in those days we didn't have like the AMP, which, was the format for the modern supermarket. So the customer would come in and have a list of what she wanted, and he would go with there was a gadget. It was a stick with a couple of fingers.
A grabber.
Mm-hmm. And he would get things down off the top, cans down off the top shelf. She would ask for this, that, and he would get this, that, and bring it to the counter. And then my mother or... when she wasn't there, my father would just ring it up, and then they'd wrap it all in butcher paper and send them on their way.
But, you know, Joe says his father was a butcher. We have on a buffet a family picture of your little boy and it's your brother and sister, and your father is missing a piece of his finger. It's wrapped up in a bandage.
A huge bandage
in the family picture, and there's probably a piece of your father's finger in some woman's chopped meat, right?
It's very possible.
It's very possible. Yeah.
That's fine and dandy.
Okay, that is not in the book.
That's not in the book.
How did you do that? Good. Let's get into some things about the book. There's something Donna wanted to share.
Yeah. We're going to have Joe do a little reading of a couple of paragraphs that really I thought were like the essential moment.
Okay, this is the opening of the chapter called The Proustian Effect. The farther the people of my growing up recede from me in time and distance, the closer I come to see the foods of our heritage as providing more than just nourishment. The aromas and flavors of our cooking are also pathways to memory. For me, all it takes sometimes is the slightest taste or a whiff of something on the stove, and in an immediate, even emotional way, I recall my childhood, feel once again the near physical presence of my parents, my aunts and cousins, all long gone now. There's a scientific reason that the sense of smell, and to some extent taste, can trigger strong memories and deep, intensely felt emotions. The human brain's olfactory bulb that registers smell, and to some extent taste, is wired close by the almond-shaped amygdala. I knew I'd have to read this on there. amygdala. I play poker with doctors, and they'll probably be howling right now. part of the brain where emotion is processed, and to the hippocampus where memories form. Psychologists call the phenomenon of memory triggered by smell the Proustian effect, after Marcel Proust, the French novelist who famously had such an experience while tasting a cookie dipped in blossom tea that his aunt used to make for him as a child. Proust used this moment as the impetus for the flood of memories that informed his multi-volume novel, Remembrance of Things Past.
Yes. So I find the book, and for you, of course, all of this must be an exercise in really holding the memories of your childhood. And this is not just true for immigrants. I think all of us are like that about the food that we ate as children. And even if, like, for example, me, I grew up in the Midwest, and now I live in the Midwest again. However, the food is very different from when I was a child in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. So, you know, cooking things. Actually, when I first started out working in food systems, I used to say to people, try to understand the things that were not necessarily what your grandmother ate, but what she could have eaten. Because your grandmother, and now at this point it would be your great-grandmother, lived in a time before processed foods, basically. And so the things that, you know, my grandmother did not drink Diet Coca-Cola, for example. So in some senses, if one is trying to still eat the original foods that existed, say, in the early 20th century, there are some, you know, as we are more and more discovering, processed foods are apparently not too healthy. So remembering what your grandmother either ate or could have eaten might help you to have a healthier diet, as well as maybe a healthier emotional life, too.
I think that makes sense. It's a nice connection.
Yeah, I think it's important for all of us. All of us had some kind of childhood that had memories of eating.
That's right.
Some sort. And I wonder sometimes then if, you know, as an older person, you say, this doesn't taste the same as it did when I was a kid. And mm-hmm. maybe you go, is it because my taste buds are kind of stale, or is it because there's not processed food, it's not made the same way?
Yeah.
Well, there's probably some of both, but
some
more
of both.
Than likely
yeah.
it's because the actual ingredients have so dramatically changed that they don't have the same flavor, let alone the same nutrient density.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, having the, like just the basic things like flour is so nationally processed and homogenized that even the flours in, even if you're using your grandmother's cake recipe, the flour itself is likely to, I mean, it's subtle.
Yeah.
But yeah, when you go, why doesn't this taste the way it tasted when it, there's a reason for it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Lebanese cooking, his cooking is very labor intensive. There's a lot of chopping. There's mm-hmm. a lot of original ingredients. And I'm the one who always cleans the kitchen. And so it's always like a huge, huge mess. I mean, it's a good relationship because I don't cook.
It's a good mess.
Yeah. So I try not to say, could you be neater? But it's,
you don't try hard enough.
I don't try hard enough. I know. Sorry.
Oh, that's good. Those memories. Joe, you talk about being up in the kitchen often with your mother. Were your siblings interested in helping your mother, too, or were they out doing things, too?
Well, I was the youngest,
uh-huh.
you know, and also I was a boy. And a boy in a Lebanese family, I mean, I grew up, you know, you talk about a prince. I never even made a sandwich for myself. I did not grow up learning to cook from my mom.
Oh, okay.
You learned to taste.
I learned to taste.
She set the standards
and,
there. Yeah.
And then when I grew up and moved on to moved away from home for the first time. I was living in Springfield, Missouri, and I missed my mother's cooking. I missed our culture. I mean, I felt I was in this very white community. You know, they're very nice people, but I missed something of home, and it often came to me in terms of food. You know, I remember one time in Missouri trying to find I got this minestrone soup. Supposedly it was Italian, and it was awful.
It didn't have enough oregano. It didn't have enough garlic.
Garlic. They never heard of it. Honestly, I actually had cashiers in down there. Is this? What is this? I'd say it's garlic. They never sold it. They didn't know.
It's true. We only had garlic salt as a child. Now my family was German. You can't imagine that they didn't have garlic in their original foods. I mean, real garlic.
They must have.
Yeah.
My mother, I still remember, she put salt and then pounded it with a pestle and mortar. It was the only way to, and you'd wait a little bit and the garlic would develop.
Would juice out into this because of the salt, yeah. But, and these are important techniques that one needs to know for cooking.
Right. So when I visited home the first time, I came back Christmas or something, and I went to the...
Would you say, Ma, the food doesn't taste good out there, you know?
I went to the Ladies Auxiliary of the Syrian Orthodox Church in Toledo, and I bought
the Fount of All Wisdom.
The Ladies Auxiliary Cookbook. And I bought it and brought it home. It was just one of those put together leaflet
spirals,
things.
Yeah.
Spiral, exactly. Mm-hmm. And I took it back with me. And then every Saturday morning before I'd go grocery shopping, I'd call my mom and I'd read her one of the recipes. But because I knew that even among the people, the Lebanese community, from house to house, things were different. Food tasted different. Good in some way, not so good in other ways, but it was different. So I would ask her, I would read the recipe to her, and she would say to me, oh, no, we don't use garlic in that, we use lemon. I cross out garlic, I put in lemon, because I wanted it to taste the way she made it.
So you learned this all over the phone?
I learned it over the phone. I remember one of the stories I tell in the book is, when I just, you know, when she was dying, and I brought home some sfihas, which are spinach pies, and I was learning at that time to make those.
They're delicious.
And but I wanted them to be like hers. And I remember bringing them back with me on the plane so she could taste them and
check it out.
And her comment was, next time, more lemon. So that was, and then I kind of refined those skills by when we blended families, we became married and blended families, and I did a lot of the cooking. We had Sunday meals, three friends' families, we'd all get together, and I usually made the meat meal, whatever it was, chicken or ham or whatever, and. We would, I would learn to cook, you know, doing that. And one of the people happened to do recipes at Cook's Emporium. And she suggested that I try because she thought I was doing pretty well. And so I started cooking at Cook's Emporium.
Teaching a cooking class.
Teaching a cooking class.
The old Cook's Emporium.
The old, yes. And with Marg. And I ended up doing maybe two or three, sometimes four a year. Ended up doing it for the next 25 years, and that's really where I sort of refined my cooking and organized my recipes and put it together.
Yeah, and that's what I was telling you before, that he had a fan base of mostly older women, who encouraged him, you know, to write a cookbook. And they were kind of bossy in the audience. And they'd say, no, you did that already. You said that. You added, you just added that. Stop. And
I'd get talking sometimes.
Well, audience engagement, that's important.
And then there was taste. And then at the end, they ate up everything that he made. It was delicious. But they were the ones who said, oh, you should write a cookbook.
And we're awfully glad he did. We're going to take a little break here and come back for a lot more recipes from Joe Gia and Fern, and we'll get into all kinds of things. But first, this is KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the Heart of Iowa. Back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We are talking to Fern Kupfer and Joe Gia about actually Joe's new book, which is Kitchen Arabic, and it has all kinds of good stuff in it. It is a memoir, it is recipes, and it is fun to read. Very good. They live in Ames, Iowa, where I happen to live too. Here we are in Ames, Iowa, and I remember meeting both of them. Ages ago, when I was vending in the Ames Farmers Market. I have a small farm and I was selling eggs at the time. And I remember, of course, you always end up talking to the people that you sell vegetables to. And Joe Gia was the first person that looked me in the eye and said, don't you throw away chicken feet. You should, when you butcher, you should keep your chicken feet and boil them down. And it makes the best stock and the good stuff, and I have been doing that ever since. So thank you, Joe.
You're welcome.
Let's talk about more tastes and recipes from this book.
We're going to get stuck on chicken feet here. I mean, they're hard to find. I mean, you know, you'd think chickens are born without feet these days.
But actually, I did find some right here in Ames at Fairway.
In the frozen section. Good thing to know. Because
and they're huge looking. I mean, they look like but size of your hand.
They might be turkey feet. Who knows?
No, they were well,
chicken feet. Yeah,
maybe so.
Well, the thing is, the chicken feet have a lot of collagen and make great stock. I'm a big fan of pig's feet, which I've recently been able to get. The problem with pig's feet is most of the smaller, abattoirs do not have the legal processing to be able to sell the pig's feet. So there is a small company at the farmer's market called Farm Story. There we go. He's selling pig's feet from they have his father's Chester White pigs, which are really large pigs, and they're processed at a place in Missouri because you need a scalder to be able to legally sell pig's feet and other parts of certain, probably the same thing is true of calves' feet because Fern says she likes calves' feet, which her mother made for her, right?
Yeah, right. It's called pachai or thistle, which is Yiddish for, I think, feet, calves' feet. But nobody, when my mom was making it, nobody could stand in the kitchen with her. I think I was one of the only ones who liked it in the family. It was delicious.
What did she do? Did you actually eat the?
They're in an aspect, but also then you could heat them and put black bread in it like a soup, and it's real garlicky and lemon.
In there too?
No.
She probably picked the bones. I mean, when I do the pig's feet, mostly I'm doing it to make the stock because the collagen in the feet, I call it velvet. It makes this really rich, thick stock, and then you cook it till it breaks down, and you're saving all the liquid from it. That's your stock. But then you pick through it, and you can pull all the bones out.
This sounds delicious to me, but you might be turning your listeners off with
this is from my German heritage, right? Because it's all in the flavorings you put in the stock, garlic or whatever. And so you pick the bones out, and then you just chop it up. And it's similar. You can make a terrine out of it. It's very similar to head cheese, for example, which uses pieces of the head. So I'm sure growing up with your father as a butcher, your mother probably got a lot of those cast-off pieces.
Yes.
Which actually make the best food.
I remember my mother. She would sit with my father. I would watch him at the butcher block, and I used to love watching him just slice through a liver or something. But my mother, he would bring her a piece of some sort of meat from something. I didn't know anything about it then, whatever it was, but she would sit there and carve it out and cut the fat away, and she would get grossed out. You know, she would every once in a while she'd be cutting, and then she'd maybe come across an artery or something, and she'd go "Ey!" like that, and then she'd settle herself down and go back to cutting, and then
a brave woman. Good.
She was brave because she saw what she was frightened of, and she went in there anyway.
Oh, very good. Very good. You talked about your many years of teaching cooking classes. What are some of the recipes that you...
Walk us through your most successful one that was adapted to Midwestern audience.
Well, I didn't adapt to Midwestern audience.
Which ones were selectively popular then?
The ones that people asked for again and again, and I demoed it over the years maybe three times because people asked for it again. It was called Mjadara.
Can you spell that?
Yes, but can you say it? That's no. What I want.
Mjadara.
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 Mjadara. You start with the M and you jump right to J. You go right. It's a lentil dish. I grew up eating it as we were in the Christian tradition. We were Melkite Christians. So we had Lenten food. And so I grew up eating it as a Lenten option or Friday meal. I must have had mjadara every Friday of my growing up. And it's essentially lentils and rice in a water-based. But what really gives it the flavor are the onions. You caramelize onions, you stir them into it, then you top it with more caramelized onions on top, olive oil, and it may not sound fancy, but it is. It's something everyone loved.
It's kind of peasanty and hearty, and when we have vegetarian friends over for dinner sometimes, they're hard to
get. Is it
soupy or stewy?
It's porridgey.
Okay, thick.
It gets thicker as it sits.
Uh-huh. And what, just and plain black, brown lentils?
Brown lentils or green lentils, either one. You can use other kinds too, but... And rice, short grain rice. Something to be starchy.
Does it cook enough that the rice cooks down or stays discreet?
It cooks down some. You know it's rice, but it becomes kind of a gummy.
But you can also put it in a lettuce wrap. We have eaten it like that, kind of like at the cafe. They have those chicken wraps in lettuce that are very delicious.
That thick.
So you can put it. Yeah.
And the only seasoning is the onions and the olive oil?
Garlic.
No garlic.
Garlic. What do I know?
No.
She only eats it. Right.
The onions are the onions add a real, real depth of flavor, but you have to keep caramelizing them until they're very,
right,
very,
so
very
caramelizing
dark.
Means you're kind of on a fairly low heat. We're not talking fried onions here. You just cook them on a low heat in olive oil, right?
Yeah.
Until they kind of begin to dissolve. They get really soft, mm-hmm. and they sweeten up that way.
That's right.
Which is what gives you that. And then I'm sure you want all of the good sticky bits in the bottom of the pan.
Absolutely.
So do you caramelize the onions and then cook the lentils and the rice in it?
You cook the lentils and rice separately. Then you stir in a large load of caramelized onions. And then you stir that in with olive oil. And then before serving, you top it with with caramelized onions.
More again.
But it's not, it's not like regular white rice, right?
It's a short grain.
The kind of rice you make is very delicious.
Oh, no, you're thinking of the riseria, which is a different type of rice.
That's not in the jedra.
No.
She's the eater.
I just eat it.
You just eat it. Whatever he gives you, just eat.
Yeah.
What a fortunate woman.
I think so.
I like to think so. No, actually, I'm the lucky one. Ask her parents.
Very good. And your recipe, the book has recipes also that have lamb in them. And I like lamb. And many people don't have this prejudice against, it's like sheep, you don't want sheep. But I don't know why, because they sure are good. And is that something that you cook often? Do you have lamb occasionally?
Yes, we have a lot. When I was a kid, we used to eat raw lamb's liver with onions.
Mm.
We loved it. It was called asabi. And, was that good.
Just chopped raw lamb.
Isn't kibbeh raw lamb, too?
The kibbeh is ground lamb.
But
with
it's, yeah, not,
meat
the, not, the, not the liver. The liver's
not the liver, no.
Very special.
Very special, but I would not do that today. But I did it back in the old days.
Well, Lana raises her own lambs. If I were Lana,
that would be different.
I would eat the lamb of... Yeah. Grass-fed, hand-petted lambs.
I kind of err on the other
educated
side.
Lambs.
Oh, they're so darn cute. Oh, that's let them grow up. But that's fine.
I think that's why, because they're babies, lambs. That's why people.
Yeah, but I'm sure when you did the lamb liver, it was not mutton liver. It was probably lamb liver.
I remember the look of disgust on my mother's face when she would get a piece of meat and she'd go, it's not lamb, that's mutton.
Yeah.
Mutton was something else. And I don't know if I would know the difference, but I probably would.
The difference is textural.
Is that what it is?
Well, because it's a lamb is a young animal.
Yeah.
So it's going to be softer, you don't have to chew as hard.
The sense I had from her was that it had a stronger lamby taste.
Yeah, it would develop more of that, with a lamb.
Which she did not like.
Yeah.
She had a very discriminating palate.
It depends on sheep varieties, especially sheep that have a lot of wool, have a lot of lanolin. And you don't want to eat lanolin taste. And older woolly sheep have lanolin, and they do taste a bit like that. But there's different varieties that don't. Anyway, it's all so good. Do you bake bread, too?
I have. To make baguettes, but then I ate them so much that I thought, this is not good for me.
So what was the common bread on the table when you were growing up?
We called it khubz arabi, and it's a flat bread.
Yeasted or unyeasted?
I think unyeasted. It was pocket. I think maybe there is yeast in it. I'm not sure.
Oh, if it had a pocket.
Yeah,
so
it
was more like
pocket.
What we would call a pita, close to that?
Pita, exactly.
Yeah. Your mom also makes something that she put on pillowcases
That was the very thin one. She'd stretch it out on a pillow, throw the pillow in the oven, pull the pillow back out.
Pillowcase, yeah.
Yeah. But I found out that this was not unique to my family. That everybody in the North
the
End
technique,
did
yeah.
it that way.
With pillows.
Yeah, with a pillow. You stretch it out on a pillow, you flop it in, pull it out.
Okay, that was probably a way to get that really thin, flat.
Very thin, yes.
The large one. Like in Middle Eastern stores, I used to be able to shop in L.A. And, they were like 24 inches by 12 inches.
Lavash.
Yeah,
lavash. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, and that is, you roll up some Lebanese, which is a kind of a strained yogurt, like a Greek yogurt, mm-hmm. with some Kalamata olives in it, and roll it up. And my mother used to give us that as a treat. She called it an arus. And arus means a bride. And she looks like a bride. She's white and tall. We're dressed in white and tall and thin. And that's an arus. And we'd say, Mom, make me an arus. And she would roll one up for us. Big treat.
Big treat.
My father, on the other hand, gave me liverwurst sandwiches behind the counter.
When the liverwurst was not allowed in the kitchen?
One of my earliest memories is, I was like maybe 3 years old, and going back behind the butcher counter and asking my dad for a sandwich, and he'd always give me a slice of bread with a slice of liverwurst on it.
So he was not just selling to Lebanese?
Oh, no.
So he had to kind of had the probably other ethnic foods that...
Absolutely. This was not a specialty market. It was a regular grocery store, of the time, of its own time.
Oh, goodness. And this is the supply trucks probably didn't just drive up and drop off everything.
Yeah, where did your father buy the meat?
How did he
do that?
The meat to Toledo.
He would go to the Toledo market. I remember that would be his first stop in the morning before he even opened up the store. He would go around 5, 6. It was always dark when he left and dark when he came home. But he would...
So it was like a meat market.
It was the meat and everything else.
And big, everything else.
Yes,
everything.
Oranges. He took me there a few times. There was... and you could buy meat on the hook. And, I would go with him, and he would pick this out, put that. And he had a regular truck delivery, too, with canned goods and that sort of a thing.
So did he have a truck that he took to the market every morning?
You know what? I really do not know.
You don't know how you got there and how you got it home.
I remember, we had a car, but I think things were delivered. I'm not sure. Uh-huh. I don't remember.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was a part of my life. You know, I was
four
or 5 years old. Yeah, I didn't remember, you know.
All the important stuff. I want to mention again, this is the Donna Lana Kitchen, and you listen to KHOI Community Radio. You can find out more about this radio station and the Donna Lana Kitchen by going to www.khoifm.org.
Okay, we're back again with Joe Gia and the Kitchen Arabic, his new book. So, Joe, you have a lot of recipes in here, and from reading through them, there are certain spices and seasonings that are repeated over and over and over again, kind of like, okay, this is your standard kitchens. Tell us what they are. What characterizes Lebanese cuisine for you?
Well, the basic seven spice mixture is called bahrat, and it's you ask anybody what their seven spices are, and you're going to get seven different spices depending on what street in the neighborhood you're on. In my seven spice recipe, in fact, has eight spices in it. One of the most common, for instance, for meats, especially lamb, and this surprises people sometimes, but that it would go well with meat, is cinnamon. We use a lot of cinnamon and allspice. Although there are, of course, you'll find recipes that people say, oh, we never put cinnamon in it. We never put allspice. but people do.
Probably more cinnamon and lesser. Allspice is very strong. Do you use smaller quantities, maybe?
Not me.
Oh, really? Okay, all right. I'm going to open my mind up and try it.
I'm pretty liberal with the...
Okay, so. And are you grinding your own?
No, I don't. I should. I don't. You know, it'd be nice. I have a meat. I have a spice grinder. But I don't use it. No.
Well, okay. Little trick. For example, you know, freshly ground black pepper tastes very different than the stuff in the can. Mm-hmm. I about once a week take a whole fistful and stuff my spice grinder and grind my own pepper that way. Because I mean, obviously, cooking. You know, using the hand grinding every time it's great for finishing a salad or at the table, but it gets really tedious. But I do grind my own spices, especially the ones I use a lot, fairly regularly.
Yeah, and
it's not hard then.
But you probably have to throw them out after a while, don't
you? No, you use them all.
You use them up.
Right, because you're liberal with it, right?
You know, Joe's a great cook, but he really isn't a foodie, and he's really a good eater too. So
that means I'm an omnivore.
Yeah, he likes he likes everything.
What are the other seven spices in your spice mix?
Oh, I knew you were going to ask me that. I don't know.
Oh, come on, you should know that.
Turmeric? Turmeric? Is that it?
Turmeric is not one of them. I've got it in the book, but I tell you, I mix it so rarely that I don't.
Well, okay, obviously you use a lot of cinnamon and allspice, and what do you use for peppers? Is there heat in your food?
Yeah, and what I like to use is something called Aleppo pepper.
My favorite.
Yeah.
Of course, sadly, there is no more Aleppo.
Well, the city, you mean.
Yeah, the city. The technique and the variety of pepper, people are now calling it, like, I buy it from Burlap and Barrel, and it's called silk chili. But that is just because they wanted
because
to...
Because the Silk Road?
I don't know why, but it is a certain kind of pepper, and it is dried in a certain way. And why I like it is because it still has a little of that broad pepper flavor. Some heat, not too much heat, but it's not just heat.
It's got a hint of cumin, but not...
Yeah. Is cumin another thing you use a lot?
I don't.
Mm-hmm.
What is za'atar?
Za'atar is a mixture of thyme.
That depends on who you're talking to, also, right?
Right. Yes, thyme and sumac and sesame seeds.
And there are different kinds of thyme depending on where you're from.
There's a Greek thyme that if you can get a hold of that, that's what you use.
Well, and I have found there's a special Palestinian thyme that I was able also to buy that from Burlap and Barrel. That is not the same as the usual Mediterranean times. They're really.
I found Aleppo pepper, by the way, at Hy-Vee.
Oh, really? Oh, good. So it's that well known
now. On the
spice
rack. Excellent. It's not cheap, but it's there.
Yeah.
See, Ames is getting with the program here.
I just bought a bottle that's like a full quart of Aleppo.
Wow.
Burlap and Barrel. Sorry, I'm online.
And you're on commission.
That's Burlap and Barrel.
We should hit them up, Rodano. Oh goodness.
No, but one time I was invited to a friend's house. I was living away from home at the time, and his wife was an Arab woman. And
she could cook.
And she could cook, and she made a wonderful meal for us. And I remember, this was early on, when I was a very young man. And when I came home, I was telling my mother, the food looked like our food, but it tasted Mexican. And she said, was the cook a Muslim? I said, yes. And she said, they use cumin.
Oh,
and that was something I grew up with too. Was
different.
We don't do that; they do this, or those people add this; these people don't add that.
Oh,
for goodness!
And that's how we end up missing our mother's cooking. Yes.
Yeah.
And so locally, you buy some foods at Pamel Grocery too. They have a lot of things that you probably need.
It's a great resource.
Yeah.
And nowadays, of course, we've got Amazon, and you can just about get anything in that.
Yeah, but it's easy to get to Pamel Grocery.
But Pamel Grocery, I've been going there 20 plus years, And Ahmed there always has a story or two to tell me.
Oh,
too.
Yeah. Well,
he's a talker. He's a good guy. But he's, I've had friends come up over the years from Kansas City, and I take them to Pamela Grossi, and I say, you're so lucky that you have this.
Absolutely. You know? It is a great resource in town for things that would be scarce otherwise.
Because what's more fun than cooking and remembering and telling stories? This is such a wonderful discussion. And Fern and Joe have a project. Tell us about your Substack project.
Yeah, Fern.
Are you giving me that?
Yes, please.
We're both writers. We both wrote books. We both taught creative writing. Julie Gamick, who's an Iowa name and a force, had called me. I used to write a column for Newsday for about 20 years, the Long Island newspaper, and then I wrote for the Ames Tribune for a while when we really had newspapers. And anyway, she called and said, she asked me, would I do a column, Substack? And I got Joe involved. I said, well, I'll do it with him. It's kind of a conversation. I don't know if you're in the New York Times.
I look
Gail.
But this is
what's
written.
Her name? This is written. Yeah, this is written. It's Substack is written. Gail, what's her name? And Brett Stevens in the New York Times.
Oh,
and
right. They do a conversation.
They do a conversation, and it's political, basically, and a liberal and a conservative. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, Joe and I can do this as a conversation. And so it's kind of fun because Joe has a painting studio in the basement and he writes in the basement. I mean, it's a finished basement. He's not like sent to the basement.
But, and you're in the garret,
and
right?
I'm in a little study off the kitchen. You do get sent to paint. And, so we do this conversation back and forth. And I guess the first one or two were kind of funny, humorous. And then we're like known as humorous. So now we have to be like funny all the time, which is
that's
kind of annoying.
Easy.
Yeah.
Considering,
oh, come on. Considering the state
that's
of the world.
We need. We all
I
have
know,
to.
I know.
You've got,
I know.
You've got your work cut out.
Yeah.
For
so,
you.
So it's called Fern and Joe and it's a Substack. And I am not quite sure how Substack works or what it is. Every once in a while, there's $6 more in our checking account, $70 in our checking account. I don't know where it comes
people
from.
People love it now. I mean.
But you can subscribe for free. So I really don't, I shouldn't say this, but I don't understand why people
pay. It's a donation, like.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a donation.
Yeah. So.
To support the people who do it.
Support the service.
Yeah. So usually I'm the idea person, right?
I'm always
the idea person, and sometimes he has the better lines, but you know, our kids always say, I take them, I steal them sometimes. Writers are notorious thieves.
That's good.
So that's been kind of fun. Yeah,
well, could we encourage you to look that up? And sounds like a good thing. And also, I wish to mention again that Joe Gia, Friday, December 8th.
Here at KHOI Live. And no, not it's not on air. It's a live reading, right?
Yeah. And the book is Kitchen Arabic.
What time is it Friday? I'm sorry.
7 to 8.
7 to 8.
Good idea. Great.
At the radio station right here. Kitchen Arabic, How My Family Came to America and the Recipes We Brought With Us. A fun read. A tasty read.
It's very interesting. I loved reading the stories. And it has recipes.
Thank you.
We always love that sort of thing. That's good. So thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Me too.
That's good. Oh, and as we are going out, we learned a lot of things today about lamb and things in the kitchen. And I didn't know you could make bread on a pillowcase. I don't think I'm going to, on a pillow. I don't think I'm going to try that, but it's intriguing.
It's probably a technique you have to watch.
In the old country, my mother never baked. Nobody bakes in the old country. They didn't have money for fuel. So what they would do is they'd go to the corner bakery, they'd take their dough
over there,
and they would do the cooking.
So they have it. That's good. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We come to you live at noon on Tuesdays, repeated at 7 p.m. on this fine radio station. Music by the Barn Owl Band today. Support this fine radio station. My name is Lana Nakigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
Excellent engineering by Mike Murphy.
Eat good food and enjoy life.